Well, I've seen online, but I couldn't fully look through.
It's all news, but that was a big thing in this day.
You guys reprinted, didn't you?
Oh, it's gone through various reprints.
We don't know how many.
They won't tell us.
What do you mean?
On?
Yeah, we're on.
Princeton Architectural Press will not reveal the sales of tooling.
So.
Well, he's doing the interview, right?
Yes.
Right, okay, so I'm like, wait, what did I have to
figure out? These are the, you did get a copy of the questions, right?
I did not get a copy of the
questions. You know what? We also didn't get a copy of the questions, for the record.
Did I?
For the record. No.
I tried to look as much as I could, like, up, material up, well, but yeah, is it possible that their website's not really working?
We don't have a website. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, no.
Well, we blew it then. Those are suggested questions, and we were hoping it would go off script quite a bit anyway and be a more general conversation. And I think it did last time with you guys. I didn't realize the reason why that it was that you didn't have the questions. But
yeah, but it was fine. Like, you know, we didn't know too much about Ciro Maje, who we did the interview on, and it was just really like a conversation. And it was good. It was interesting.
So probably just get started a little bit with those, and then just move.
Yeah, let it go where. Yeah.
Or whatever.
And when you're stuck,
whatever you want.
When you're stuck, just go to one of those and ask it. And
sure.
And it should be a conversation too. I mean, I'm here really as sort of chaperone, and to make. Sure, there's been a couple of times when people have tried to avoid questions, and I've said, no, wait, you can't do that.
Right.
Especially when it's a particularly good question and an off-script question, so I'm here for that. And I might ask one or two, but generally I'm here just to facilitate, and also to encourage you guys, Ben and Chris, to ask smart questions back. You know, if he's asking you something that you find... You know, particularly turn it back on him.
Who do you think the best?
Yeah, well, just for example, me and Eric and Productora.
Who was there from Productora? Was it?
Wine.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and Eric asked Wani, you know, what three words would you use to describe your practice? And then he turned back around and was like, well, what three words would you use? And I think that was really...
You're allowed to do that?
You're allowed to do that. You're encouraged to do that.
Doesn't that like...
Yeah.
I thought after middle school that kind of a move was off.
I think it's still on, so...
It's back. It's back. I just get to start with like one of the questions about here. And... So, who are the ones, like, who do you consider your generation, or the kind of reference, the group of people that your generation would be?
Who do you consider your generation?
You
have to answer first.
I was going to say.
Who do we consider our generation?
Or your peers, like, who you talk to.
Or people that you consider some in terms of your work as a reference, or you know that there's some sort of exchange with.
I mean, certainly there's a lot of talented architects working today, and a lot are in New York and. We have a good informal exchange, a good kind of casual exchange, but I don't think that we kind of position ourselves relative to any particular practice, or if we have any kind of particular intense exchange with anybody in particular.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the next questions will sort of illuminate more about that first question, or I wouldn't say our reluctance to answer it, but I do think that I do think the need to define, you know, a certain kind of output through a shared output through kind of collaborators or, you know, other people in the field or a generation, like, is a false.
Okay, case. But so if I turn that around a little bit, like, what is the context of New York then in terms of that, or what do you think is particularly for you working in this city? Like, why is it that you obviously got educated here, you went to school here, but, like, why did you stick around? Or what does that offer you in terms of other references, in terms of an infrastructure, in terms of a discourse? I don't know.
I think the reason like we find it difficult to answer the first question is precisely because practicing in New York really opened up a very let's say complicated way of becoming a practitioner for us. Mm-hmm. Like we there were a lot of opportunities when we left school. It was this kind of the late 90s, and there was a lot of interest in media technologies and communication and so forth. And we kind of asked the question when we left school, like, how what can we do to not do architecture?
I would be curious also to continue on the idea of being in New York or not being in New York, or you're from Chile actually, right? You told me earlier. It's like one thing that I always find striking in the way like that we work, or that I, in that case, my partner Mario, he's in Chile for most of the time, but I kind of switch back and forth between Europe and the West Coast. And it's a kind of a nice position. I feel that it's something that really matters to me, to be like as an outsider to these places at the same time, and that only, you know, happens if you kind of leave for extended periods of time again. So you get your own perspective when you get back. So do you ever consider I'm not quite sure what kind of question I get out of that, but
I think maybe what, if I could read into the question, what you're asking is if being sort of from the outside kind of keeps your perspective fresh, or you know, being a, let's say, a foreigner, that it allows you to remain inspired, or to look for things in a certain way. And I would say yes. Certainly, we all love to get out of New York, but we really became the architects that we are, I think, because of a almost vernacular, because of our fascination with vernacular qualities in this city, and also with other people that we work with, for instance, in Arizona. And Chris has a past in Arizona, so I would say that, you know, as opposed to what you're saying, that we define ourselves and see ourselves as an American practice.
Mm-hmm. So tell me something about the New York vernacular.
Well, for instance, we learn how to be the architects we are from a few projects, I would say, key projects for us that were really about working with this city. Mm-hmm. And not in an architectural fashion, but rather through like a way of learning, or kind of kicking off projects that let you look at the city in a unique way. And one of those was by working with a pigeon flyer in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And also with some billboards. Mm-hmm. Particularly one billboard in Queens. And it's, you know, they were very unique to this city, and it took a while for us to even realize that they were there. You know, it's kind of one of these things, like you're sort of almost more fascinated by something that's in your backyard because it had always been there, and something like, I can't believe I never thought of.
No, but this is exactly what I mean. And sometimes it actually the going out of a place for a little moment or for a certain amount of time, like, completely makes these things, or it makes them appear once more. But
Can you just expand that a little bit and talk about those two projects, one of you, a little bit more in that?
Sure. Well, the pigeon. Should I talk about the? I'll talk about the pigeon project.
Sure.
You can talk about the color shift. The pigeon project was a project about how to look at the city from the point of view of a flock of birds, and it was particularly important to do that at that time. I think this was 2002, maybe three, because this is pre Google Earth, but there was a big fascination with geographic information systems and information technologies like that. You saw a lot of satellite imagery everywhere. It was starting to pop up in ads, you know, in car ads and all this stuff. And we really were interested in problematizing this notion that everything is on the grid, and that's the kind of inherent that's a sort of inherent property of the world in a way. I mean, this was what was becoming apparent with GIS and its protocols. And so we did this project that wanted to complicate that put a mapping device on a satellite that had no kind of control, that was a little out of control. Well, very out of control. Well, somewhat in control. We got the cameras back. But anyway, we considered these birds satellites, and how they would see the city would be, you know, because they were off the grid, our point of view was we would get something out of that. We would get something out of that that was different from what you could get out of, say, Google Earth.
There are rules at play in a flock of pigeons, but they're just kind of not as obvious, and they're not as easily kind of accessed or controlled. Kind of figuring out what those rules were, just kind of meditating on what those might be and how they might shape their behavior and in turn shape their kind of the way that they interact with the city. And now with the kind of information that you can glean about the city from those kinds of from those kinds of movements. Oh. Like, really?
It's a long night.
But it really formed a kind of trajectory for our practice moving forward that coalesced in tooling. So it kind of started, we started with pigeons, and we're kind of ending with architecture.
Do you want to talk about that transition from pigeons to architecture?
Well, When we wanted to be a little bit more explicit about kind of what the control devices of these satellites that we were creating, what those were,
the birds,
yeah. The satellites. We all understand what.
right.
The satellites. You know, we started looking at them as and realized rather quickly that you know. That flocks of birds have been a kind of hallmark thing to study in as regards to emergence or self-organized activity. And so we started to delve into this, and we looked at we looked at computational models. We made our own kind of observations, our own kind of empirical study of this stuff, and we realized that there certainly are rules at play, but that the rules. We'll never be able to describe everything. That they can give you insights. They can give you a relatively good simulation, but they're never going to be able to describe. They're never going to be able to describe everything or to solve the mystery. But what we kind of realized is that it was kind of enough. It was enough to start with. It was enough to start designing with. And this kind of way of kind of exerting control in a way that also opens up avenues for losing control in a way.
Yeah.
Seemed like a really interesting way to think about design.
That's, yeah. I mean, that, if I could build on that last comment. I mean, certainly, like, developing your own techniques, let's say, for us was always about getting inside of a dynamic that you have a loose or a kind of distantiated relationship with. You know, you can't quite... I mean, it has to be... It has to kind of have a ragged edge, in a way. It has to be slightly out of control, because that's the only way that you learn, both about what you're doing, but also about the kind of, you know, the world outside of you. I mean, this is how the practice of architecture can become, for us, like a kind of meaningful way to interact with things out there, both knowledge, but also real things, like birds. So that ragged edge, you know, between sort of, let's say, order or disorder, or between kind of known rules and unknown rules, is a kind of vital area, and that's exactly the area that we wanted to practice in, or create an architectural practice.
So does that then also translate in your work in like kind of open-endedness of the project, or how do you say the kind of the losing control in a way? Like, how does that manifest itself? How does it actually make itself into the project, in the design process? Can you just tell us a little, talk a little bit about how that shapes the process and how that actually then manifests itself in specific strategies within the project?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't want to get too deep into specific projects, but, you know, you could say loosely that, you know, we are, like, a practice interested in developing kind of orders, let's say, like, that are sort of geometric and let's say, kind of mathematically determined. But only at the service of understanding kind of where you might find a limit, you know. So, for instance, one project that we've been kind of repeatedly going back to over the last few years is uses quasi crystals, or, you know, aperiodic assemblies to build objects, essentially. And it's interesting for us to explore this idea because it's inherently a kind of let's say a set of rules that is always slightly out of order, but only through its, like, rigorous modularity.
The geometric order is highly rigorous and was really difficult for us to kind of to concoct a tools for producing this order. And inherent to the, what's so interesting about it is that it's absolutely modular, but it never repeats the same way twice. Mm-hmm. So there's like an infinite, it has an infinite ability to kind of absorb information. So instead of a kind of maybe more conventional modular system that's based on repetition and in the end is kind of closed, a quasi, like an aperiodic order is kind of open-ended by definition because it's constantly changing, it's really hard to pin down, and it's always like on the edge of instability. It's actually not, but it seems that way. And certainly, and trying to interact with it in the design sense, it's always going to seem a little bit unstable.
So, what do you describe? What role does the computer play? What role does a computer play, and how do other, you know, how do, well, let's start with the first one. What role does a computer play in your work, then, or digital processes altogether?
It seems strange, like, now to, not to criticize the question, but it seems strange to try and be specific about that, because it's almost like, you know, what is oxygen? What's the role of oxygen in your practice? You know, it's
breathing.
Is it just breathing, though? I mean, Well, let's start with breathing. Yeah, I mean, it's we have this fundamental and possibly dogmatic way of looking at nature, and it might even be deterministic, that we see both ourselves and something like, if you were to say, the computer, and also sort of when we look at birds and we're looking at stuff out there, we see this all as kind of one dynamic, with properties that as practitioners in architecture we can engage. So, I mean, this is, you know, we looked at, in a way, the flock of birds as a computer. So, you know, if you ask, like, what is the role of computers playing your practice? For us, it's kind of that, like we...
I was hoping for that kind of answer.
I was not
looking for it now that you tell me a little bit about kind of what softwares you use and so on.
Yeah.
Actually, I was curious, actually, about exactly that part, the... I would also like, I don't know if that's the right, but I would actually like to ask you a question. Because at the beginning, you were...
Wait a minute.
I would be curious to hear from you, as you said at the beginning, that you set up these offices or the pairings in a way that there was some sort of...
I want to hear this.
The button off.
I want to hear this.
where these relationships... you basically explained that there is some sort of underlying relationship you see. One that is most likely or hopefully not quite obvious, but where you see kind of somehow... there's a merging at moments. Like, I would be curious where you see the merging of what you guys do and what we do, or in the way we think about things or work on things. I'd be curious to hear that and then also continue a little bit.
Well, there were two places. Mm-hmm. One is really Dublin, and there was the Chilean connection, which is really... specious, I would say. I mean, I don't.
When you put it as the Chilean connection, it does sound a little, cryptic.
But then also, the kind of surface house, if you will.
The wall house.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the wall house has a real interest in that making of surface in a really mm-hmm. specific way, mm-hmm. and. Ben and Chris's work was included, and I think we read it slightly differently, but I think that some of your work really is about surface too, and so it was actually the surface connection, mm-hmm. which is less obvious because I think for you guys it's a bit of a stretch or a bit of a slightly different read to understand your work in terms of surface, but we already had in praxis.
Yeah.
And as I said, that particular project has a really explicit interest mm-hmm. in surface, and so that was the way where you two came together. And actually, where you and Dan and Amal come together was over it was the House in Heat mm-hmm. and their sort of environmental mm-hmm. interests mm-hmm. too. And actually, you guys have it's maybe a slight stretch to read it this way, but I think you actually do have a bit of an environmental. Interest in not a kind of tree-hugging, green, warm and fuzzy way, but in a kind of technological and like what can you read out of the environment more. Mm-hmm. And I think that that particular house at least is engaging environmental technologies mm-hmm. in or addressing those issues. Mm-hmm. So that was another kind of, there are those three uh-huh. things that, but as I said, there was enough difference at the same time that there was significant difference too, mm-hmm. and that's how we ended up pairing mm-hmm. people. And I mean, they're very imperfect at times because when you have 11, there's some that really seem mm-hmm. obvious that they need to come together. For example, we really thought that Meejin Yoon, Howler Yoon, and The Living should come together because they're both into that do-it-yourself electronics kind of thing, and I think that there's a really but there's also a base that's a connection, but there's also a huge difference, I think, in the way that they design.
There's also, I now hear you speak about your work a little. Also, I could see another reference. And, I mean, it's I can see...
Yeah,
another
Mom's doing that too.
Sorry. I just peed. It's all right. Go ahead.
It's the losing the control.
It's
right?
Losing control of my coffee cup.
But it always like a certain interest in rule systems, which has been like, for example, if you look at I don't know if you had a chance to look at our website. There's the one Magnus Nord one, which is this crystal like. It's actually a building. It was a building proposal for Cologne and. It turned out to be this crystalline like structure, but the kind of rules that we that we were looking into was a quite different one out of a different context in certain ways. It was actually taking these the building rules within the building in Germany, inner city building, which are quite tight, very serious, and almost literal, basically making readable or giving form to a legislature in a way. Because, I mean, there's basically just two systems underlying it. The one is there's a setback rule, quite simple, and then there's one of a definition of what is a full floor and what is a roof floor. Out of that, and the strange thing is that normally what you see coming out of these kinds of things, I mean, we know suddenly it's a box and within the envelope and you're done. But if you really play these out to the absolute limit in a way, it turns out that this like perfect crystal, it's a mixture of on a visual level, it's like it almost looks actually like the Matterhorn in a strange way, but it's a very crystalline structure. And again, it's like a moment where we give up like our wanting to control the design in a way to some degree and letting these rules play out in a very manual fashion. I mean, over and over going through it and remodeling it, but like ever more like trying to tighten or getting almost like a closer grip on what these actually what happens when you, how these rules formalize. And strange enough, what we did actually, we got a lawyer on the design team, like a building lawyer. And again, so like it's kind of playing on this rule system and finding like, you know, where to intervene, where to go in, and where it actually takes you for a moment. So I could actually see some overlaps also along that route.
Mm. But yours tends to be more geometric, though, right? And mathematical.
Procedural.
Procedural.
I mean, yeah, there are.
And you do that through the script.
There are rules, and then there are rules. There's,
I mean, I think you're right. What's similar there is, you know, you're looking for a way to mediate your decisions, mm-hmm. like as an architect. You're looking for a way to. Like distanciate your own, let's say your own opportunities within a milieu that has its own kind of propulsion, and the idea is to kind of let that propulsion express itself as perfectly as possible without your own contamination.
Constraints.
Yeah. And yes, but I would add to that the rule of legislation for determining, say, programmatic issues, right? Or
not really. Okay, go ahead.
For determining programmatic issues and other issues are sets of rules that that establish a kind of let's say a game, mm-hmm. where and games have kind of rule sets, mm-hmm. but they're within a kind of on a game board. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that you know that game board is maybe a different game board than the one that we're interested in. I'm not even too sure if we're interested in a game board, to be mm-hmm. honest, like because games have a kind of like this sort of false edge in a way, the referee or the kind of, you know, they can only work within a kind of framework or a bubble. Great for an architectural practice to do that and to have that constraint. But ultimately, like, I would say, like, the rules that we work with, like, we're trying to really see, to see kind of our own, like, our own decision making, like, and even the need sort of as a kind of cognizant, aware agent within this milieu, like, that we are kind of on that game board itself. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Right on. In a fundamental way, I think they're related. In that it's about developing relationships, explicit relationships, and between kind of rules and motivations and resultant form and performance. Where I think maybe there's this distinction about who sets the parameters of the rules, or who sets the legislative bubble that we're operating in. We're on the game board. That's what I'm getting at.
Pretty cryptic.
Yeah. I mean, the issue I would say, like, okay, so you end up with a kind of crystal structure, you know, but is the crystal structure, like, really teaching you about crystals?
No, I would agree. I wouldn't even say that it's like the goal of the thing. It's almost a byproduct. I mean, it's not something like we've not been carefully looking into crystal logics, crystal structures, and so on. And I don't think that was the goal of the project either. Yeah. I mean, that's just like let's put it like it's a form of coincidence. Let's say that. But
what does that coincidence teach you? That there's something inherently, let's say, expressive, like geometrically expressive about legislation, right?
Yeah.
Or about.
Well, I think the interest was basically, to a large degree, a general interest of ours is actually to look into these what I would call like the deep structures of, you know, or of, call them deep structures of architecture or whatever. These are the things that are within the realm, within the bubble that you're in, that you practice within. There's a set of rules in the largest sense, and there might be economic ones, there might be legislative ones, and so on. But they're mostly in themselves, they're not visible. And like in this in the process of designing, actually, you kind of play them out to actually make them apparent and see like how they do actually structure in the most. And that was like, in a way, putting it to the extreme. How does it actually in its most clearest way, or what's the word? In its most pure way, yeah. How does it suddenly manifest itself into a formal structure? I think that's a little bit that was the focus in that kind of work.
Yeah. It's interesting, like, because for there are these like really there are these parallels. Like for us, geometry itself is a way to see the unseen. Like, without any kind of external information, you know, it's a kind of this exfoliation it's an expression of that. Like without, like, you know, like blowing smoke in the wind. You know, geometry is without it, you only have this kind of invisible dynamic. But once you activate it with a kind of expression. Suddenly, things are apparent, useful, and activated.
You know, one of the questions from the list, I'll just if you don't mind my throwing this out there, since it's on the list anyway, and since we're sitting in this space here with all these magazines around, is what do you look at? You know, what are your what publications, what are your influences, what things do you refer to?
Practice. And I'm
you get nice 10 try. Out of 10 points.
Nice try. I mean, I'm looking here at there's Icon, Step, what's this? The Special Report of Typography, Graphica, Print, Blind Spot, Wallpaper, Arcane, although Arcane is cheating because it's yours. ID, Matthew Ritchie, Seed.
Yeah, that's.
You're busted.
Busted. Well, we should say, like, we only have stuff in the conference room that's magazines were published in. So, maybe that's.
Maybe so, that. Oh, so these are all ones that you've been published in. Okay, so then, so then what are you
doing? So guys? We only read that.
So cravenly narcissistic.
Talking of being in the bubble.
Yeah, exactly. What are we reading? I mean, we do Chris, what are you reading?
It's not like what are you reading at home, like, right. You know, I don't want to hear Agatha Christie or something.
Well, maybe that could make it in.
I mean, do you go to detail? What do you look at?
We do go to detail, actually. It's difficult to be totally frank to answer questions that that pretty directly like try and expose your kind of work habits or your kind of way of arriving at an end. I mean, I read the newspaper voraciously, like every day. That's one thing I'd be happy to divulge in this interview.
Yeah, it's interesting. Some of the groups are very open with that. Why are you secretive of it? Why is it hard for you, or why is it difficult?
Well, I think it's difficult. It's not that I'm trying to hide anything. I just can't kind of think of anything like meaningful to say about that. We read a lot of magazines and blogs, and everybody does.
Yeah. It seems like I don't have a commute anymore, so I don't read the paper as much as I used to. And I think if I think about it, I have to admit that I just kind of surf, and then maybe it's a problem.
Well, then on a larger, okay, then maybe on a larger, one of the other questions that's related to that, or who are your mentors, or who are your influences? Not so much peers, but people or things or institutions or that have influenced you.
Well, we definitely, there's collaborators on projects that have been influential to our project, to our practice, and they run the gamut, like a basket weaver that we worked with for this one project in Arizona. He's from Arizona, and Native American basket weaver Terrell Dew Johnson. We've had a long-standing relationship with Matthew Ritchie, the artist. He's really kind of taught us a kind of range of lessons about architecture. An engineer from London. From Eric. And I would say, like, these people are, you know, they kind of like really infuse the project, the practice with a real kind of like a way of working.
institutions like the MoMA and Design Miami have been have given us great projects and great opportunities. And then there's a host of galleries that, particularly one, the Johnson Trading Gallery is like our representation here in New York, and he's kind of held out. He's like worked with us for like 4 years or something, like going through all these crazy sort of open-ended possibilities in how we could produce objects, you know, that he can actually introduce into a market. It's been really kind of fascinating. So there's really a lot of people.
Wilson Bentley, the
yes,
the touchstone inspiration for us, the guy that first photographed that made all these photographs of snowflakes at the turn of the century, the turn of the last century, was the first one to discover that, or to discover and prove, I guess. I don't even know if it's proven, but that no two snowflakes are the same. He proved it by taking thousands and thousands and thousands of photographs of sit-ins with his homemade camera on his farm in Vermont through many, many harsh Vermont winters. Just going out there every day. And he died up there, actually. Got pneumonia, a storm.
And what's inspirational about that to you? The relentlessness of it, or the...
Gotta go.
I mean, it shows that the kind of narratives in science and in art, and he was using photography, which was a kind of untested discipline, that like there are these kind of overlaps, and none of them are kind of complete, and you can contribute to each one of them from the other. You know, so he was a photographer who actually was making very profound realizations about the natural world that hadn't been substantiated by science yet, for instance.
What kind of animated his study is this, his search, what is this rule of six that demands that nature conforms so rigidly to its law. That the snowflake conforms so rigidly to its law. Yeah. He knew there was something there, but there at that point there hadn't been a working model of the atom. There wasn't a kind of a scientific explanation for it. So he went about looking for it the best way he could. It's like going out there and looking hard.
Yeah. So as we are right now at the relationship of science and arts, and maybe like one other word that could come in there is it's also here, it's the question of research and in how far that constitutes a new form of practice, and what's the relationship between research, writing, and design work for you?
Yeah, they seem to all collapse into one foggy, one foggy state of trying to get something done. I mean, we like to describe like these other practices, like Wilson Bentley, the photographer, or the Basque weaver. Because they approach they approach like these discoveries or like the productions of these objects from the side, in a way. Like they're not about like the thing itself. You know, this is like the beauty of making a basket. Like it's not really about the object. You know, and I think you can say this is true in architecture, that ultimately what basket weaving does is, and what Terrell taught us when we worked with him to make baskets, is that it's really about the relationships that exist around the object. So when you make a basket, you do so in a kind of communal environment. And there are things that you say or that you sing, and there are people that you want to make the basket with in order to share stories with that person about whatever histories you want to impart. So for us, like that, that seems like a way to encapsulate like a practice, like an architectural practice, that it is about certain things, very discrete things. Like if you were saying research, like yes, basket weaving can be described as a kind of discrete practice of up and down and warp and weft, mm-hmm. and a kind of a sort of technical approach to it. But it's also about very kind of universal things as well. It's about these narratives that get told around it, and it's about the relationships that that get built, you know, around the making of that object. So, you know, I would say, like, yeah, I mean, it's about many worlds. You know, it's not just about kind of one thing.
Seems like a good place to end it.
Now, you know, there's one more on there that I really
we're not even
at 46 minutes. Oh, we're at 46 minutes, so we don't want yours to be half the length of everybody else's.
I'd like to ask that, actually. So, how can architects maintain their relevancy during crisis, specifically environmental and/or economical? What role, if any, did the profession play in the current housing or environmental crisis? How do we continue to be productive without purely escaping into paper architecture or theory, and without completely abdicating responsibility for large-scale mediation of the planet? How do we continue to be productive without escaping into paper, or without purely escaping into paper architecture and theory, and without completely abdicating responsibility for large-scale mediation of the planet?
Without completely abdicating.
You can answer any one. One of those is a pretty.
Yeah.
But what's the gist of the question?
The gist of the question is, you know, how obviously we're in economic crisis right now of sorts, an environmental crisis of sorts. How do architects, in the face of this, maintain their relevancy? What do you do now? That's simply.
Where do you consider your responsibility as an architect in that? I mean, do you consider there is a responsibility that you have as an architect that's any other than your personal responsibility in that? And like, if so, like, describe that, maybe. And maybe it also could include something, I mean, because I could see also I would go that far that it's actually quite it's, from my perspective, even an almost healthy point probably for the discipline on the long run. Maybe, so what do you see as potential outcomes or possible positive or negative outcomes for the practice as large?
Well, for our part, it's forcing us to be, the tough economic times are forcing us to be a little bit more creative about where where we find work, and it's, in that sense, it's kind of. So it's interesting to reflect on your practice and think about where in the world what you do, or what other kind of corners of the world what you do could be valuable. So one thing we're doing is we're starting up a collaboration with a manufacturer of temporary structures to come up with with a number of, modular architectural products and stuff that can be stuff that, that's appropriate for like for a rental market or for temporary
hurricane housing.
Hurricane housing.
Yeah.
Emergency shelters. Stuff like that. So I mean, so in that sense, on the one hand, it's kind of interesting to kind of look inwards at these moments when stuff slows down and there's not as many opportunities, there's not as much information kind of coming at you from the outside anymore. You have to kind of look inward and then think about things before you can turn your gaze outwards again. And so in that sense, I imagine it can only be healthy for the practice.
But if you consider maybe the extent, I mean, if you consider that like 100 years ago, like more or less 100 years ago, they would consider, you know, there's the mechanical revolution.
Yeah.
That would bring forward a specific idea about architecture, a specific way to go, to think, to produce, to make architecture. Do you think like that now? You know, from all you just said earlier, you read the paper every day, so like wherever you look. Kind of get this feeling, okay, like we're going into whatever it's called. I really dislike the terms, but it's like the green revolution. So there's the green economy, there's green collar workers now, there's all these kinds of things. Do you also think that if that really has the magnitude that is suggested on an everyday basis today, does it actually bring forward, does it change the practice? Does it change the way we think, the way we produce architecture for you? Or is that not something that you're so concerned with?
I mean, you would be you'd be an idiot in today's architectural world to say that, you know, that green is not is not an influencing factor, right? So, but I have to say, like, we talk about this a lot, but there's the green economy is one thing, but you have increasingly this this problematic. I would say there's an ideology of ecology that is really emerged. That's which is almost this thing that you can't kind of question. You know, that if it's ecological, then it's good. Like, and there's a kind of you know, there's a problem there because it's a kind of closed system in a way, and the definitions or the kind of complications of how we work within a kind of ecological framework, I don't think have been fully fleshed out.
No, exactly. Yeah. I would agree, but yeah. I mean, so do you? I mean, do you consider that a challenge, or?
I mean, we take the approach that interest in very fundamental procedures, both in architecture, but also just out there in the world, like it might not be inherently a green approach. But it's a way to decompose or to break down what we see out there in the world, and that's I think on a fundamental level a contribution to this ecological like kind of debate, you know, or this gestalt that's kind of emerged around it that has no you can't sort of you can't question it. I mean, on an easy level, it's like, yeah, reduce, reuse, recycle. Yeah, I mean, everybody, always, and every project, the right materials, you want to choose stuff that that produces the lowest impact. But that's who cares?
That's not a design.
No, yeah. That's not exactly.
Yeah.
I mean,
but it's really at this other end of like we have a responsibility as architects to accelerate our I think our kind of understanding of how to build and how to construct in the world. I mean, it's not just about like the movement of materials. Like, it's also architecture is about the production of knowledge, and we have a responsibility to produce and see this knowledge that we have access to, and it, you know, the question of responsibility really comes comes at that point. It's like, well, you know, when, if you're going for the end game, if you're accelerating things and you want to see the kind of end of it, like, are you responsible for that?
But, well, I would argue that even terms like the responsible, like the word responsible is really problematic for me, and the word sustainable is really problematic for me too. Yeah. I mean, in nothing that you really care about, you would ever describe as sustainable. When you describe your relationship with somebody as sustainable, it's pretty much close to the end, I would say. And also the word responsibility puts like such a strange connotation on it in a way. But I would almost, and I think maybe there is, even in the way it's worded most of the time, there might even already be a difficulty in there, because I mean the terms that are out there is kind of, I think, give a difficult outlook on the issue. But then, if you look, for example, at the, that's like from my perspective, which, you know, if you even look back in the I think early 70s or mid 70s, when Banham did the architecture of well-tempered environment, and I think that's what, I mean, for its time, it was actually quite interesting. Even reading it today, it's like basically saying, okay, that taking the focus away from the just structural part of it, and then saying there's actually all the, you know, the some of its other writing, framing the term environment in a broader sense, but then even looking into all these means of creating those. I think, I mean, I would be curious in how we could actually get a hold on the whole issue as architects that goes beyond the kind of logistics of making something sustainable, choosing the materials that are, have a smaller impact and so on. But like, I think that's also where my question was going. It's like, where do we actually intervene in a way that is an architectural change, that changes architecture, the way we think about it? And how it might inform architecture beyond like just an engineering feat, which is, you know, better R value, U values, and so on.
Yeah. I mean, some of these issues are being dealt with in certain sciences, like in material science. You know, we've had the fortune of working with some material scientists on some projects, and you know, they really deal with energy storage and distribution, but really just dealing with it like one molecule at a time, or one layer of molecules at a time. And this is like a sideways answer to your question, but you know, all like discussions of like how to, let's say, be like what you're saying, like sustainable, like are slightly kind of ridiculous within that context as well, because they are after sustainability inherently, mm-hmm. or you know, it's a kind of inherent drive to capture and release the most out of a material as possible. Now, the interesting thing is, like, when you get down to that level of the atom, like you're really dealing with certain rules, and they're very geometric, and they're very structural in nature. So, and the kind of behaviors that are useful, like the kind of things that become, say, the batteries in our cell phones, or for our cars eventually, and you know the things that will really motivate the changes that that will be felt, like in our cities and in our neighborhoods. Those changes increasingly are becoming the result of a kind of emergence or of a kind of self-assembled nature. And you know this is where I think it's so interesting to kind of complicate the issue of ecology. You know, just because something is kind of highly engineered or let's say self-assembled, doesn't make it less natural, right? I mean, nature itself is a kind of is a kind of constantly repeating set of catastrophes, right? Or things that are out of balance. So, you know, it's as if like we need to constantly introduce more things that emerge out of balance in order to kind of solve more and more of our problems. And this is the kind of like this is the sort of motivation that we find ourselves in now. As architects, you know, we hold that some of these tenets are valuable to the design world. That you can produce things that are self-assembled and are out of balance, and that will have a contribution to the kind of wider milieu that we practice in, both you know, in ecological terms and also like very real social and technical terms. I mean, I think this, you know, once again, to go back to the beginning, you know, to be out of balance is a deeply kind of critical way of practicing.
Up until the Learning Line project, there a lot of your work, specifically the baskets, I always think of as being a certain form emerges from an almost inevitability of a material process. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
And in the Morning Line project, the form seems to come from the drawings of Matthew Ritchie and actually has not so much at all to do with the material process at all.
Material process. Right.
Do you see that as a kind of, just because it's one of the most recent projects of yours that I am really familiar with, do you see this as a pivotal point in your work that you're moving away from that kind of work or into something that's more, this is going to sound critical in a way I don't want it to, but it almost seems graphic to me, the Morning Line parts of it.
Well, it is. I mean, it's an exercise in drawing, so in a kind of planar construction drawing.
I'd say it's a pivotal project for us in that it's the one where we took on most directly and most deeply this issue of expression, the relationship between expression and structure. But in a way, it's funny because I think of it, the Morning Line, as in a way as like the most synthetic, the most integrative project that we've done, because the drawing. I mean, it's kind of starts and ends with the drawing, and the geometric system enables the drawing, enables a small drawing, and then it enables the small drawing to come together as a big drawing across space and across scales. So the kind of form and the geometry, or in the end, the expression and the geometry are really, in actuality, very closely linked. And another kind of goal that we set for ourselves was to also collapse the to collapse these issues in a kind of tectonic way, in that the drawing is the structure.
Mm. And so the space.
And the space.
And the instructions for building the piece.
And the instructions for building the piece.
Yeah, yeah.
So...
But the drawing isn't... I mean, there's a lot of pieces in there that are unnecessary structurally, no?
Possibly.
But the idea is that there's no framework outside of the drawing. Mm. To hold the thing
But
up.
There isn't an inevitability... the way there seemed to be in some of your other work. And in fact, like the materiality of it, I mean, it could be, it happens to be out of steel, but it could just as well be out of another material. There isn't deep, intimate relationship between the material and the way it is in the log cabin or in the... No? Maybe it's one project that happens to be influenced in that way because it's a collaboration with an artist, and that's the mandate of the project, and that's the material of the project, if you will, that I'm not putting words in your mouth, but that is the material of the project rather than the drawings of the artist are the material of the project versus the, you know, the, whatever you call it, the straw of the basket. But it does seem to me to be a quite different than a lot of the rest of your work. And I mean, as I sit here and look at some of these, this seems more, I don't know what the material of, I should say what they are, it's a project called The Wrap, which is, these are the temporary structures that you were talking
about.
Yeah,
these are obvious.
But there seems to be more of an inevitability between form and material in those than...
Yeah, I mean, without getting too deep into that specific project, I mean, you know, there's...
Into which specific project? Into
the morning line. I mean, it's a collaboration with an artist interested in drawing as a way to to basically understand the universe, that the universe itself is a kind of drawing, like the universe and how we understand our kind of perceptual reality is in fact a projection from a higher dimension, and so this is the kind of holographic principle that you know Matthew introduces into his work and into this project, and that ultimately everything is a kind of map. And so we were asked to produce like a kind of mapping that would self-assemble and organize into larger spatial structures. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a kind of I understand what you're saying, and you're kind of implying that there's a that somehow mapping is kind of maybe is less deep than sort of other kind of material, you know, possibilities of this thing. But ultimately, it had this kind of like kernel or this resonance with Matthew's artistic, you know, practice. You know, and we hold that it's a kind of interesting that the expression of geometry is an avenue that our work is going in, and it is interesting. I mean, the drawings that eventually became like the larger structures, there are a lot of kind of rules that are played like within them. I mean, it's difficult to like when you say like is something necessary or is something not necessary. It's hard for us to really know that, because the idea of expression is that expression collapses a lot of kind of competing agendas, right? It's like expression is a kind of like becoming that can be a becoming sort of many forces, both of gravity, structural, but also because it's expressive of other things. And, you know, those other things are ultimately the, you know, this was the issue with the Basques as well. It's like it's the other things that really carry the narrative. You know, I think you can't sort of pry them apart in a way that's very that's sort of easy. You know, and ultimately the project is so it was so interesting to engage it as the architects because, you know, Matthew really came to the table with this challenge, which is how to introduce or how to convert a language into a place. Or in other words, how to like introduce narrative into architecture. And you know, we feel like you know, this idea of narrative is something that's been missing from the debate for a while.
Yeah. Oh wait, do you know what the next issue of the press is?
Narrative? Stories?
It is.
Nice. Good.
It's a little plug for it.
Yeah, to be continued. Thanks a lot for coming by and doing this. Yeah.
Anything else you want to say?
Oh,
Vindicate yourself? Anything you want to...
No, I think I've... I feel like I've talked a lot. I'm kind of...
Topped out. Okay. Well, we're having all these turns.